Good morning. This is the oral history interview with Mr. Arthur L. Stinson at his residence for Dr. Flint's Brooklyn Oral History Project, New South Voices, on Monday, April 23rd, 2007. Mr. Stinson, thank you for having me here at your home for this interview.
You're quite welcome. The pleasure is mine, sir, and I'm looking forward to this interview very much.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship to the Brooklyn community?
I was raised in Brooklyn. I was educated in Brooklyn. This is when the city was quite smaller than it is now. We were sort of self-sufficient. And of course, we were subject to the Jim Crow laws and things, but I think we tried to make a good situation out of a bad situation. And as we go along, I'll try to explain the reason how we did that.
Where did you specifically live in Brooklyn?
I lived on East Hill Street near what's now called Outlet Square.
Okay, and what schools did you attend while you were there?
I attended Myers Street Elementary, Second Ward High. 6 years at Myers Street and 6 years at Second Ward, all in at a block apart.
Okay. Can you tell me any memorable experiences that you had at those institutions?
Well, I might mention I also went to John C. Smith a couple of years also. But I had quite a few experiences. I was very fortunate to be able to attend these schools. I lived in a section of town back even elementary school. They had social services, and we had some very dedicated teachers. And we even had teeth pull, fill, and elementary school. I went to Second Ward High School, where they taught shop, automobile mechanics, mechanical arts, cooking, shoe repair, and bricklaying and concrete finishing. So these are some of the things we were able to pick up to make us very independent and self-sufficient for later years in life.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about the major businesses that existed in Brooklyn before urban renewal, like near Brevard Street, Second Street?
Yes, in that particular, we had a theater, known as the Lincoln Theater. We had AM Design Publication House. We had a professional building called the MIC Building, located on Brevard and 3rd. It was one of the first buildings, three-story buildings, owned and operated exclusively by Negroes. A lot of these professional offices were in there, lawyers, doctors, and of course beneath was cafes, beauty parlors, and barbershops. We had on Second Street, we had a second in Brevard, we had a library there, the first big predominant black public library on the corner of Brevard and Second. Also many restaurants owned by blacks, and some of our more affluent people own service stations in that area that more or less service the neighborhood.
Can you tell me about some of these specific business owners that you might remember that might not be prominently known in the history books?
Well, come to mind right quick, Bishop Dale had a Amoco service station on the corner of 1st and Brevard. He ran a Amoco service station in the corner. We had Dr. McQuarrie ran Queen City Pharmacy for all of our drug needs that we need for help for prescription field. We had predominantly black. We had McKissick Shoe Shop. The owner of that, we had El Chico at 1 and 2. Had one on 2nd Street, right off Brevard Street, owned by Mr. and Mrs. Ingram. And also they had one down in the center of Brooklyn on McDowell Street, off the corner of 3rd and McDowell. There were many, many barbershops and beauty shops and things in this area that served predominantly black people.
Okay. Can you Can we discuss the House of Prayer and its specific influence in Brooklyn and how Daddy Grace influenced the entrepreneurship in Brooklyn?
The House of Prayer was a church that did a lot of wonderful things for the community. They were more or less self-sufficient. They was more or less kept to themselves. In other words, if you was a member of the House of Prayer, they more or less married within the church. At the time, back in the day, they primarily met and married people within the church. Also, they were self-sufficient in the way that they taught their own people how to play different instruments. They had some of the best bands that were taught by their own members of the church. In fact, not just one band, they had several bands in each church, each house of prayer. And they were taught how to play the piano, all the horns, the drums, the whole thing, and they marched all over the Northeast United States from New York to Florida. Marching. And one of the biggest things in Charlotte here, we had what they call a week of convocation where you had baptismal service, where they baptized, and also they had a parade following. And then they had white and black alike turnout for the parade. It started on 3rd Street, went from 3rd Street to 4th Street, up 4th Street to Bavard Street, left on Bavard Street to Boundary Street, down Boundary Street to Alexander Street, right on Alexander to Bavard Street to 1st Street, down 1st Street to Alexander Street, then to Boundary Street, left on Boundary Street to McDowell, and then McDowell back to the House of Prayer. You couldn't hardly find standing room. As long as this route parade is, you couldn't hardly find standing room. It has been said it's one of the largest spectacles that was in this part of the country. And this was strictly all black, all the way.
Did the House of Prayer own any businesses or have any business influence in Brooklyn?
They had businesses, but not to what they have today. They paid for their churches as they built them, as they do now. But they just didn't have it. They weren't the churches themselves wasn't as fine as they are today. But what they done, they paid for it as they went. In other words, I know some of the other faiths weren't able to do that. House of Prayer did. They paid for the churches they went along.
How were they able to do this, sir?
Not being a member of the House of Prayer, I'll give you as best I can. But I strongly suspect that they took the monies that they took in and plowed it back into the church itself.
Okay, so that talks about some of the self-sufficiency of Absolutely. That, which was also kind of a foreshadowing of what Brooklyn was like, too. Can you talk about some of the other businesses in Brooklyn? For instance, Everybody Need to Eat. What about the supermarkets that were located during that time, sir?
Well, only supermarkets. You only had two large supermarkets during the day. You had A&P, Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, and the Colonial Stores. And they changed the name from Colonial Store to Big Star back to Colonial Stores. Those were the only two giant supermarkets that we had locally. And you didn't have but two or three of them in the whole city. Of course, the city at that time was not as large as it is now. We had local stores in our own individual communities that we bought most of our groceries at. Because of lack of automobiles to travel in and carrying your own groceries, you had to carry them by hand or pull them in a wagon or catch a cab to take your groceries on. And then we had local smoke shops that supplemented the grocery stores, which would supplement people's salaries, to all your smoking products, ice cream, bread, vienna's, potted meat, canned sardines, canned salmon, things of this sort. and many other things that you could buy in your little smoke shops. This was a ways and means of making a little money that the mothers and the children could do during the day when the father was out trying to make a living at the many various things and some of these little stores, these what we call smoke shops. Also, they sold beer. So,
do you know of a specific location where one of these smoke shops was located, a popular one?
Well, they had them all over. Now, these you can find two or three in every neighborhood or more. They were just all over everywhere. They weren't hard to find at all. In other words, where you found a few homes, you're going to find a smoke shop because there's money to be made. That needless to say, when you're selling beer, I don't need to, you know the rest of the story.
And it's the truth.
In addition to that, there were subcontracted businesses. Can you speak to those, like plastering, the brickwork, wood yard, coal yard?
Yeah. Yes, there's quite a bit of subcontracting going on. And the bricklaying area, cement finishing, plastering, yard work, things of this sort. But we was able to pick up some of these trades that I referred to earlier. Some of the best bricklayers and masons we had in town were trained in Second Ward High School. They were taught how to lay bricks, how to figure mathematically how much sand, bricks, and mortar mix you'd have to buy in order to build any size house or any wall, no matter what the thickness. Also, with mechanical drawing and all that, and read a blueprint, they were taught how to do this also. So some of these things that we were taught in high school, some of the young men that are now retiring age right now, they learned their skills in high school and took it on to earn a very good living all their life with the things they picked up in high school. We are quite proud of some of them. I could name a few of them, but the Polk family, for example, in the brick land business, was very popular in the Greertown area. They came up and they were educated at Second Ward. Some of them went in the insurance business. The Greer Funeral Home Service, the business was located in Brooklyn, but they had some excellent training at Second Ward as far as learning the business and then being educated, John C. Smith, and keeping some of this talent at home. But the teachers back in the day, they were very influential in our lives because they were very, very strict. The goal was, back in those days, was for every child was to finish high school. Parents were very, very strict about finishing high school. It was also, and then my generation, it was important that my children finish college, four-year institution. Now, my children, it's necessary now for them to go on to grad school. So, as you can see, progress has been made down through the years with the insistence of parents realizing that we need to get strong and better as we go along in this world.
And thank you. I heard you mention about, you know, you had some people that did insurance. Can you talk about the Afro-American Mutual Insurance Company and its importance to the Brooklyn community?
Well, yes, we had quite a few insurance companies. I'm trying to think. Winston Mutual was one of them. Mm-hmm. In particular, I hesitated because I had to separate the white insurance company from the black. So, but I remember specifically Winston Mutual, and they had policies for almost any type of insurance you wanted or you could afford. Almost anything that you wanted to buy from them. Back in the day, and of course, they did it a lot different back in that day. The insurance collector, the insurance man, came door to door collecting insurance and little policies hang up inside the people's house on the wall. They take the book out, fill it out, write down the amount of money you paid when you paid the date. As precise, now we send a check in, and we do it different. But back in the day, they used to come around and collect it as people got paid.
So is it common for other business entrepreneurships to have close ties with the community, to come to people's houses and leave, you know, goods and services?
Well,
such as one reference might be the how people did their ice back in the day, or their coal or wood.
Yeah, there was a lot of bartering going on. The ice man, the coal man, the wood man, also the little neighborhood smoke shops that I spoke of. A lot of people ran the bartering system with the owner. I pick it up on Monday, I'll pay you on Friday or Saturday. As to when they got paid. But back in the day, most everybody worked 6 days a week, at least five and a half. And sometimes they didn't get paid until after 12 on Friday. On Saturday, because if they did, they wouldn't come to work. That's fact. They paid them on Friday, wouldn't show up.
Can you discuss the importance of the family unit in the community and how that helped a sense of being with Brooklyn, how everybody was interdependent, and how that spread from the family unit to businesses?
I think, yes, I'd like to speak to this. There's two main differences right now that I think of right come to mind. We were raised by the community, not just our individual parents or relatives. I mean, you might be 10 blocks away from your home. Most people in the neighborhood knew whose kid you was, and they would give you a spanking and send you home and tell your parents, and you got another when they told your parents. Also, there was two things allowed in school without question: prayer and discipline. Teachers felt free to do this in schools. I think it has made a world of difference. You were made to go to church, not sent to church. Your parents were there with you. You were in front and they were behind you coming along. If you had three services on Sunday, you attended three services. You had very few people at that time, for those that had grace in y'all, very few people that cut lawns on Sunday. The Sunday was known as the Sabbath. Most people cooked their Sunday meals on Saturday and just warmed them up on Sunday. Sunday was church day. I think that it might have had something to do with my parents' parents, where they were born and raised in the country, and they fixed the meals, and they had to go a long way to church. And I think they got in the habit of fixing food on Saturday so they could take the dinner to church with them, because it's too far to go to church in the morning and come back and then go back to eat. So they took dinner with them, and they stayed at churches. After church is over, it's sort of like a social hour for about an hour or two, everybody talking about the crops. Boys got to talk to the young ladies and vice versa. But I think back in those days, we were much closer unit as a family. And I think that by being raised by the whole community, there's a lot much better system than I think some of the things. I think this is some of the reasons why we're experiencing some of the things that we experience today. But there's a lack of discipline because it's just not practiced like it was back in the day.
In addition to that, can you speak to how it was important to have professionals and everyone living in the same community and helping to enrich that area?
Well, yes, all your professional people lived in the same neighborhood with everybody lived together. Doctors, nurses, ministers, and that helped a whole lot. Because you never felt like they were better than you, or up, although they had the education of a lot of people, and they had to go to them for help for filling out papers and things of this sort. But you felt a more closeness and togetherness. And I really think, and we were, those of us that were in school, kids coming along, we were encouraged to see that what they had done, in spite of all the problems they had being raised up, that going to school, you could still make something out of yourself and be somebody in life. And looking at them every day as they go to work, you know. And at that time, they were going to work dressed up, whereas versus wearing jeans as the blue-collar workers. So it gives you it gave us something to shoot for, to look forward to, and something to really, we knew it could be ours if we worked at it hard enough.
That's important. Can you discuss what you know about the Blue Heaven section and where it gets its name from and how that related to the Brooklyn community?
Blue Heaven is a part of Brooklyn that runs between Independence Boulevard and Moorhead Street, bounded by McDowell Street and Outlet Square. And it got its name from a little creek runs through that section. And they got its name from the blue water that flowed down through the little creek. And it came from Charlotte Laundry, which was located on 2nd Street and College, New Way Laundry on the Boulevard and Boundary, and Domestic Laundry off the intersection of Moorhead and McDowell. And all these laundries poured their laundry wash water into the creek, therefore turning the water blue. That's how it got its name, Blue Heaven. So this renamed the section the people lived in, Blue Heaven. That's where the word blue came in it. And Blue Heaven is nothing more than a little creek just flows through, and that was turned blue by the sewage from the laundries.
Were there any black business owners in that section or businesses?
There again, we go right back. So your little smoke shops, maybe pool room or two. But basically, it was just you had a couple stores there. But they, for a while, sometimes they'd be owned by black, sometimes they're owned by whites. We were able to get in a couple of them because the whites sold out and the blacks bought the store and kept it going. But basically, it was just a neighborhood where people live. Nothing, say, extremely special about it, except the blue water running down the creek.
These smoke shops that you speak of, can you kind of describe the physical layout of what one might have looked like?
Most smoke shops are about the size of a 1 to 2 car garage, enclosed, with shelving put in inside of them. The whole of canned goods, ice cream for the drink box in them, and also ice cream box for the tobacco products, and maybe a piccolo, and place to store the beer. They sell it at a counter, say a beer. But they weren't very large, but they were very, very active. Between the piccolo playing and drinking the cold beer on the weekend and at night, selling the bread and the meat during the week, during the day. Some people done quite well with smoke shops. Some people done quite well with them. And occasionally, they would get a permit from downtown and would sell fried fish on weekends and chitlins or this type of thing. I'm going to leave it alone now. And they would.
Okay, thank you. Can you talk a little bit about the businesses that promoted nightlife in Brooklyn? It is known that Brooklyn had an exclusive nightlife, especially on the weekends, where people would come from all over to come to the Brooklyn community. Can you talk a little bit about some of these businesses and places that would draw and attract blacks from all over?
Well, yeah, what they call nightclubs, if they can be called that. And what it consisted of was a building with a few tables and chairs sitting inside of it, and a bar across on the side or in the back of it where alcohol beverages were served. And usually some combo outfit, maybe a drum and a couple of people playing horns or something of this nature, something to dance to. They were quite plentiful. You really didn't have too many places to go to because, as far as the clubs go, and they had quite a few of these all over Brooklyn. You know, they had just by different names. For an example, J.C. Graham had a drugstore on one floor. The back of it was a pool room, and upstairs a nightclub. And it's just too many clubs, too numerous to tell you, but they had all these little clubs that they had, they call nightclubs, basically some a little better than others, play a little different type of music. But as a general rule, it was somewhere to go, to have a sociable drink, to listen to some music and dance to it, and try to spend the afternoon. And most times you had to go elsewhere to a restaurant to get something to eat afterwards.
One such place that was referred to before was Sunset Park. Do you have any recollections of Sunset Park?
Oh, yeah, but that wasn't in Brooklyn. That was across town in Belleville. All right. That's the reason I didn't bring that up.
Okay. Excuse me. Can you talk about the Green Willow Garden?
The Green Willow Garden was a place where many things went on. They taught boxing there. They had a lot of fights. This is on 2nd Street in Brooklyn. But on 2nd between Bavard and Caldwell, next door to Queen City Pharmacy before they moved to the west side. And they had a place that they taught many, many boxers learned their skills at the Green Willow Garden. We had one, his name was Pitt, and I'm trying to think the last part of his name. I can't. But he climbed, I don't know, he got to be number five in the world. Came right out to Green Willow Garden. I'm trying to think of the last, Parks was the last part of his name. Parks was the last part of his name. But he went quite far. Raised up right there in Brooklyn. Just like Charlie Sifford. He's a local Charlotte boy. Golfer. Mm-hmm. Golfer, I think the world knows about him. Jim Black came that close to win the Los Angeles Open. Right, local. Born, raised right here in the city of Charlotte.
Other things that people did for entertainment, can you speak to that? The different theaters, the library that they use, Brevard Street, and some other things around that area?
They did. Of course, you always had your fishing and your hunting. And it did back in the day, you had plenty of room to do that. But speaking of the culture things, most of your plays and things, for an example, in Second Ward High School, they had an auditorium built right in the middle of the school. I remember specifically hearing the first time I ever heard Marian Anderson perform was when I was in high school. She visited my high school. She sang right in the middle of right in school. So we had a lot of quartet singing. Back in the day, quartet was very, very popular. Back in those days, these singing groups, you didn't have too many mass choirs back in these days. And then there was a lot of note singing. Do, re, fa, mi, sol, la, ti, do. A lot of this was going on. Singing hymns, long, short, common meter, this metered hymns. A lot of these things were being used at the time. We sing those things. But people in general, wherever they came from, they brought the special things with them, the different type of recipes, the different type of things that they ate from different parts, and then the food, the dance, their culture, everything that they learned from the part of the country they came from. They lived in Brooklyn. We had a cross-section of a little bit of all that. So we're very fortunate to live in that particular neighborhood. And today I look at it and it brings to mind so many things that when I walk through there, it just doesn't look like anything I used to know from that area.
Can you talk about your experiences at the Queen City Classic and how that was a major social event in Charlotte?
Yes, the Queen City Classic was a crosstown rivalry between Second Ward High School and West Charlotte High School. And at that time, you only had two black high schools in the city of Charlotte. Second Ward on the east side, West Charlotte on the west side. And of course, we played each year for the bragging rights for the city of Charlotte. I was fortunate enough to play on three of the Second Ward Tigers team. And yes, we saw the success of the years I played.
What position did you play?
I played guard. Right guard, right guard. It was a large thing. Even the white neighborhood on the east side pulled for Second Ward, and the whites on the west side pulled for West Charlotte. Harding High School was located on West Trade Street. Central High School was located on Central Avenue, and they have the same color Second Ward had. And Harding has the same color West Charlotte has. We used to take the old uniform they used to give us to try to make out the kidney pads, because we played partial without kidney pads, shoulder pads, and all that kind of stuff. We just didn't have it. We used what we had. But it was a wonderful thing. And back in those days, we could draw, for a high school game, we could draw 25,000 people back in those days. That was a big thing.
And where was it played, sir?
Memorial Stadium. Mm-hmm. Same place, Memorial Stadium. Mm-hmm. And we had, it was something. It was really, really nice.
Let me ask you, what do you think about the, moving on to the subject of Brooklyn and urban renewal? Can you give me some thoughts about how you found out that Brooklyn was going to be razed and removed from the community?
Yes, by being active in the NAACP and several other groups, I was made aware of in its early ongoings. I think, and lots of things, I think it was a good thing to tear down some of the old houses, because a lot of them were shotgun houses. But there are some sites that I feel like they should have left for historical purposes. And of course, the moving part, you know, there's never seems to be enough houses when you're moving for a whole community to move. So for a while there, they scattered the people in Brooklyn all over everywhere in town to find a place for them to live. And as we did so, homes began to sprout up on the west side, south side, north side. All these things happened. But the big major change came after World War II, because that's when they started building Double Oaks and South Side, Brook Hill, and all these things, therefore creating houses for the people that were moving from old Brooklyn.
You spoke about involvement in the NAACP. Can you talk about the Alexander family, Kelly Alexander and Fred Alexander, and some of how they contributed to the things in Brooklyn?
The Alexanders are a very, very prominent family. They resided in Cherry community, as we now know it. They owned a funeral home in Brooklyn. And they was on Bavard Street, right next door to the M.E. Zion Publication House, right off the corner of Bavard and 2nd. But they were very instrumental, very, very instrumental in the NAACP. They ran a successful funeral business for many, many years. And I It's my understanding that they're still in the business now. At least they go up under Alexander name anyway. But they were instrumental in getting a lot of laws changed and the betterment for black people, not only in the city of Charlotte, but in the whole United States. Because a lot of things that Kelly fought for on a statewide level and a national level, as he went forth with the help of Julius Chambers and a few other black prominent lawyers, they were able to accomplish quite a bit for the injustices that the black people were suffering at the time and still suffering, some of them to this day.
You mentioned that they owned a funeral home in Brooklyn. Can you talk about how the funeral services were different back then? The funeral homes provided like ambulance services and some other thing. Can you talk about the difference in community businesses that way?
Yeah, well, back in those days, the funeral home did serve as an ambulance service in addition to your burial services. And we only had one hospital, Good Samaritan Hospital, which is located on West Hill Street, off of Graham and West Hill. But in addition to the funeral home, like Mr. Alexander was very, very instrumental in helping people to fill out the insurance papers, teach them how to draw Social Security, fill out the paperwork for the insurance companies so they get their money from the insurance companies, applying for disability for people with disabilities problems. These are additional services into their funeral service, plus the NAACP. They were doing this for the community as a whole with very little or no charge, which is an excellent service that they perform for the neighborhood.
I was going to say, Good Samaritan Hospital, can you talk about how that, where was the other hospital? Because wasn't Good Samaritan the one that would take blacks?
Well, at the time, it was known as Memorial Hospital. But basically, at the time I'm talking about was, we called it Good Sam. But that was predominantly a black hospital. But the Memorial Hospital is now called Carolina Medical, which is located off of Scott Avenue and Baldwin Avenue and King's Drive and Scott Avenue. That's what I want to say. But it's now known as the hospital of, That Memorial Hospital was the name of the old hospital. It's Carolina Medical now. That's what it is now. Same hospital.
Let me go back and revisit some issues in Brooklyn. The way the community was seemed pretty self-sufficient and very vibrant and thriving. What do you believe was some of the contributing factors? Do you think urban renewal was the only thing that caused it to demolish its community, or what were some other contributing factors to kind of break down that structure that was in the Brooklyn community?
Well, first of all, the need for the black man to excel, the need to do better, period. No matter what it took, we realized that we were only going to be able to rise above to pull ourselves up. We had to do it by our own, pull up our bootstraps. This is what we had to do. We knew that. Your parents push you to do better. You can do better than this. Just existing wasn't good enough. They did not accept it. These were unacceptable. So you tried harder. You tried to do better. They said every generation must get better and better. So every generation comes along, if necessary, to get a better education, to make more money, therefore you live better. period. Economics. Just that simple, pure and simple. And then you need knowledge in your head. So once you made the money, you knew what to do with it, how to invest it, how to look forward to the future, how to educate your children. Because my parents felt like they had an opportunity to go to school. They saw so many things passing them by, they simply wasn't qualified for. Or you applied for a job, and they say you don't qualify. That's why it's so important that you get an education. We were told you must get a good education.
And these things, how was this kind of, this notion kind of lost in the transition of time, do you believe?
I think some of it was lost when things got a little better, people got a little more money, started moving around, and they started taking things for granted. I came up during a time where you had to earn the work for what you had to earn what you got. I think too much was given to our young people without making them feel like they had to earn it. And I think as a result, things came too easy. I think too many parents said, I don't want my children have to go through what I went through with. And therefore they gave them more. But I think this hurt us more than it helped us. The idea was to help my child so they don't have to go through this. But I think they'd been better off had they been put through this. I think that's one of the major differences right there. That we as adults, we need to tighten up and make them realize that whatever they get in life, they're going to have to work for it. Nobody's going to give you anything. You have to work. You have to work hard. You have to earn it. And when you earn it, then you know how it came. You'll take better care of it. I give you a car that I paid for. You don't know how you got it, except I give it to you. But if I buy a car and make you work to earn the money to pay for it, you're not going to tear that automobile up.
When we were talking about urban renewal, you spoke of the shotgun houses. Could you describe what the shotgun houses looked like and how prominent they were throughout the Brooklyn community?
Yes. They were, most of them were just straight through houses, 3 to 4 rooms straight through. You could stand in the front door and look out the back door. Straight through. And some of them you couldn't even walk between. They were so close together. So if one caught on fire, 3 or 4 of them would burn down before you get the first one out, especially on a hot summer day in the 90s. Well, a lot of times you had spontaneous combustion. So when we say shotgun, that's exactly just shaped just like a barrel of a gun, straight through.
And when the houses did catch on fire, who would relieve these fires?
Relieve?
Yes. Who would put the fires out?
Oh, the fire department, They would come out. They had fire hydrants in the neighborhood. But they didn't have, and like I said, they had fire department sort of centrally located around the city of Charlotte, so like they do now. And so, and we had alarms on the poles, telephone poles.
The fire alarms were on the telephone poles?
Yeah, well, you pull it down to call the fire department. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, you had, now they put mailboxes that drop mail to the mailman pickup. We had mailboxes in our individual neighborhoods. We go to certain corners, they had mailboxes there. Now you want to drop, you either go to the post office or go to a shopping center to find a drop-in box.
Were there black firemen?
No, sir. Okay. That's another thing. I've had the pleasure during my lifetime of seeing black firemen for the first time, black postmen, black policemen, liquor stores, rockets being shot out in space, televisions, all these things. Oh, and I won't go into the VCR, computer, and all that. But all these things, I feel real blessed that they've come loose during my lifetime, that I've been able to see all these changes take place. And I have some wonderful, wonderful memories in my head concerning these things and looking back in the past and comparing back in the day with today.
Okay, the policeman. It was said that the black police force was put into the black neighborhoods because some of the crime, the white police didn't want to come deal with it, so then that's where the black police force came from. When did you first see the black? Do you have any recollections of the black police in Brooklyn? Or?
Yes, sir. First of all, they were policemen, but they weren't. There's two reasons we got wound up with black policemen, I feel. First of all, it wasn't so much that the white policemen couldn't handle it. It was a crush that the people were demanding that we have black policemen along with black postmen and this type of thing. Second of all, when they first made black policemen, they could arrest them and they couldn't take them to jail. They had to call a white policeman. See, they only worked the black neighborhood. Later years, they were able to arrest anybody and work any section in town. But when they first started, they only worked the black neighborhood. And that's about the size of that one.
Well, I wanted to just talk about urban renewal and the fact that people were deeming Brooklyn as a slum. Can you give your take on whether it was a slum or where this came from and these disparities and why people would, you know, kind of try to push for that notion?
Well, back, yeah, it was a slum. But we as black people, we didn't dwell, we knew it was a slum. We knew it wasn't going to change unless we stood up and fought for it. Just like the city with the problems we have nowadays. There's so many injustices going on right now that you came along to this club, that club, what have you, what won't you? You know, this not coming, it's not happening overnight. Let somebody go to court. Let somebody sue somebody. It wasn't any different back in those days. It's just worse. We knew we wanted better housing. But in order to have better housing, we needed more money. You have to understand, some people paying 75 cents a week. Some people paying house rent $1.25 a week. If they had made better houses, we wouldn't have been able to afford them without the education to make money. That's why I keep going back to economics. You can't get away from it. Money talks. I don't care what color you are, money talks. That's about as straight up like me.
What I wanted to ask you is that most of the slums, as it was referred to as far as the slum housing, it said that it was owned by absentee white landlords. Can you talk about, did you know of any of the landlords and how they dealt with the housing? And
well, same thing. That's just like I just said. It's true today. Most of your slum houses are owned by white absentee landlords. Nothing's changed, remain the same. Do you realize that most of your slum houses doesn't get fixed up nowadays for the same reason they didn't get fixed up back then? That's what I keep saying. The same thing over and over. Owned by the absentee slum white lord that's not going to put any money in it. They just want to make money. They're not going to put the broken window panes in. They're not going to fix the air condition. They don't care about the heating unit. The same problem exists today that existed then. You go in a rundown neighborhood, apartment complex, the same identical thing. I think you. I think I can't explain any better than that, and I can't. And that's fact.
Okay. And say, is there any other situations or topics concerning Brooklyn that we haven't discussed that you believe is important for people to know about concerning the community and concerning the history of Brooklyn?
Well, I just feel like this in a summation of what we said today. I feel like what I'm saying, it means more to some than it does for others. For those of us that came through back in the day, we can see it vividly in our memories. We have a mental picture of how things was back in the day versus what it looks like today. It's sort of like asking somebody, hey, do you like being pulled around with a mule and wagon, or you like riding in a Cadillac? There's no choice to be made. Everybody wants to ride in a Cadillac. I think that what I'm saying to you is that we realized we needed to do something to make a change. We hope that our generation has made enough inroads towards progress. And as I look around, I would like to think that we have made a difference. I don't think we made as much a difference as we would have liked to. But I do feel like we have contributed and contributed heavily. I would like for the history book to read that we did try. We tried to improve upon that which was bad when it seemed impossible. I feel like we did do a lot of things towards that end. The work is definitely not finished. There's much work to be done as has already been done. And I'll continue to work until the day I die to try to get some of these changes to take place. I thank you.
All right. Thank you for having this interview, sir.
Thank you for asking me.